Over the years, I've participated in a number of theological conferences, gatherings where Unitarian Universalist ministers present and discuss scholarly papers about their theologies. It's always very stimulating and exciting intellectually, but frustrating and challenging to try to translate the scholarly ideas into everyday living. Ideally, of course, your theology, your convictions about what is of ultimate concern and value should influence how you live. Your understanding of yourself, the way you relate to other people, the kind of society you work to achieve. Most of us human beings, however, have a strong tendency to say one thing and do another. We don't mean to do that. We're just phenomenally good at putting our ideals in one mental compartment and our activities in another. But there are some few courageous persons who, with great effort and determination, struggle all their lives to bring these compartments together, to make their theologies or values evident in their lives. William Ellery Channing was such a person. He was a small, frail man who never wanted to be a radical. But he felt called to articulate a new theology and to live accordingly. He was born in Newport, Rhode Island in 1780 and raised in a family of culture and education. He was educated at Harvard and, after great inner torment, decided to enter the ministry. He was called to the Federal Street Church in Boston in 1803 and remained with that congregation throughout his career. And ministers don't seem to do that much anymore. Jack Mendelsohn's biography of Channing is aptly titled The Reluctant Radical. Channing's lifelong reluctance to take radical stands was directly related to his theological convictions. Those same convictions, however, forced him repeatedly to speak with passion and eloquence on the social issues of his day. Calvinism was the dominant theology in New England Congregationalism when Channing was growing up. God was seen as all-powerful and human beings as inherently sinful. Channing, however, believed in a God of love and benevolence, and a Jesus who was fully human. What these beliefs meant to him was, first, that human beings are born with the potential for becoming good and loving persons, and second, that if only that potential for good could be encouraged in individuals, society would be transformed. Channing considered his life work as a minister to be the development of goodness and tolerance in the people he was called to serve. He spoke out against anti-Catholic bigotry and worked with his good friend, the Catholic bishop, to improve conditions for Boston's poor. This same commitment to a path of acceptance and tolerance of differing views made it difficult for Channing to contribute to dissension by answering the theological attacks of the Orthodox Calvinists. And in later years, he was cautious at first in speaking against slavery because he disliked the abrasive activities of the abolitionists. Reluctant or not, in 1819, Channing accepted the challenge of answering the theological attacks of the Orthodox. Until that time, he and other liberal ministers had avoided controversial issues in their preaching, ignoring the angry words of the Orthodox who demanded that the liberals admit their heresies. Channing finally spoke in Baltimore at the ordination of Jared Sparks and set forth the theological position of the Unitarian Christians of that time. The sermon was published and has been called the most widely read sermon in America. Channing proclaimed a theology which freed human beings from the tyrant God of Calvinism, the guilt of original sin, and the neglect of reason in reading the scriptures. With a loving deity and a human example of perfection in the life of Jesus, the responsibility for good and evil was placed upon the individual. Each person was called to develop a just and loving character. Channing was greatly admired, and his optimistic theology was seen as a basis for the wave of social reforms which characterized much of the 19th century. The abolition of slavery was the major social cause taking shape during Channing's life. As a young man, he spent 2 years in Virginia as a tutor and was nauseated by the slavery he saw for the first time. "There is one object here which always depresses me," he wrote. "It is slavery. This alone would prevent me from ever settling in Virginia. Language cannot express my detestation of it." And yet he was strangely silent on the issue for many years. In 1819, when Missouri asked to be admitted to the Union as a slave state, Channing said nothing publicly. Mendelssohn points out that Channing's spiritual vision was forever blessed or cursed with a comprehensive perspective. He considered slavery to be morally wrong. But how could a nation so entangled in a vast, entrenched system of evil find the moral strength to extricate itself? A Baltimore abolitionist, Benjamin Lundy, visited Channing to enlist his help in organizing abolitionist societies. But Channing was wary. His benevolent and comprehensive perspective is evident in a letter he wrote to Senator Daniel Webster in Washington. He wrote, "A little while ago, Mr. Lundy of Baltimore, the editor of a paper called The Genius of Universal Emancipation, visited to stir us up to the work of abolishing slavery in the South, and the intention is to organize societies for this purpose. I know few objects into which I should enter with more zeal, but I am aware how cautiously exertions are to be made for it in this part of the country. I know that our Southern brethren interpret every word from this region on the subject of slavery as an expression of hostility. I would ask if they cannot be brought to understand us better, and if we can do any good till we remove their misapprehensions. It seems to me that before moving in this matter, we ought to say to them distinctly, we consider slavery as your calamity, not your crime, and we will share with you the burden of putting an end to it. We must first let the Southern states see that we are their friends in this affair, that we sympathize with them, and from principles of patriotism and philanthropy, we are willing to share the toil and expense of abolishing slavery." To narrow one's perspective to a hatred of slavery was not enough for him, lest the power of that single-minded rage end in sheer destructiveness. What his perspective lacked was empathy with the feelings of slaves. But in 1830, the Channings spent 6 months in St. Croix, and there he took upon himself a series of face-to-face discussions with slaves. According to his biographer, Channing once passed a slave woman who was singing. He asked her why she found her work so pleasant. She answered decisively that she did not. Channing said to her, "Tell me then, what part of your work is most pleasant?" She answered, with much emphasis, "No part pleasant. We forced to do it." Channing commented in a letter that these words let him into the heart of the slave. He began to outline a major essay on slavery. Still, he hesitated, and the essay was not completed and published until 5 years later. On his return to Boston, he did preach an anti-slavery sermon, but when asked to join the anti-slavery society, he refused. He could not perceive Southern slaveholders and moneyed Northerners as a mass of immoral or evil people, when to him they were individuals with varying moral capacities. Abolitionist Lydia Child had many conversations with Channing, of his caution, she wrote, "I learned that it was justice to all, not popularity for himself, which made him so cautious." It was Samuel J. May, one of Channing's protégés, who finally reached him with a personal challenge. One autumn day, while May was listening to Channing's routine carping about the harshness of abolitionist language, his patience snapped. "Dr. Channing," he said, quite forgetting his usual reverence for the great one, "I am tired of these complaints. It is not our fault that those who might have managed this reform more prudently have left us to manage it as we may be able. It is not our fault that those who might have pleaded for the enslaved so much more eloquently, both with the pen and with the living voice than we can, have been silent. We are not to blame, sir, that you, who perhaps more than any other man, might have so raised the voice of remonstrance that it should have been heard throughout the length and breadth of the land. We are not to blame, sir, that you have not so spoken. And now, because inferior men have begun to speak and act against what you yourself acknowledge to be an awful injustice, it is not becoming in you to complain of us, because we do it in an inferior style. Why, sir, have you not moved? Why have you not spoken before?" There was a moment of tense silence, and then Channing replied, "Brother May, I acknowledge the justice of your reproof. I have been silent too long." He published his essay on slavery and was immediately in the center of the storm. Old line members of Federal Street Church stopped calling at the Channing home. Some even refused to speak when passing him on the sidewalk. As Mendelssohn writes, he who had been an object of almost mystical adulation was suddenly a pariah. Thereafter, he spoke out repeatedly on behalf of the rights of abolitionists and against the annexation of Texas as a slave state. When Channing's friend, abolitionist Charles Follen, died on a burning ship, Samuel May, on behalf of the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, requested the use of the Federal Street Church for a memorial service and was turned down by the standing committee, though every member knew that Follen had been one of Channing's dearest friends. Channing memorialized his friend from the pulpit anyway. Then he addressed a letter to the committee, relinquishing his salary and asking that his public functions as pastor should cease. Shortly before his death in 1842, Channing was vacationing in the Berkshires. On the fourth anniversary of West Indies emancipation, Channing asked to use the Lenox Meeting House pulpit to memorialize the event. In his final public utterance, he said, "We were told that emancipation was to turn the green islands of the West Indies into deserts, but they still rise from the tropical sea as blooming and verdant as before. We were told that the slaves, if set free, would break out in universal massacre. But since that event, not a report has reached us of murder perpetrated by a colored man on the white population. We were told that crimes would multiply, but they are diminished in every emancipated island, and very greatly in most. In truth, no race but the African could have made the great transition with so little harm to themselves and others. The spirit of education has sprung up among the people to an extent worthy of admiration. There is reason to believe that a more general desire to educate their children is to be found among them than exists among portions of the white population in the slave states of the South. Emancipation can hardly take place under more unfavorable circumstances than it encountered in those islands. The master abhorred it, repelled it as long as possible, submitted to it only from force, and consequently did little to mitigate its evils or to conciliate the freed bondmen. In those islands, the slaves were 8 or 10 times more numerous than the whites. yet perfect order has followed emancipation. Emancipation conferred deliberately and conscientiously is safe. Perhaps we are all, like Channing, rather reluctant to be radicals in any cause, no matter how just. Channing's God of love and reason made him reluctant to condemn others, but also led him ultimately to what was in his day a radical stand. Who or what is your God? What ideal guides you in your search for truth and in your actions? What are the social causes we face today? What are the roots of your reluctance to take a stand? What is the source of your courage to stand firm when necessary? Channing lived out his theology as best he could, having the courage to do so even when his personal comfort and popularity had to be sacrificed. What is even more remarkable is that however passionate he was in his own convictions, he was able also to affirm the freedom of others to articulate their own views. The free mind was of ultimate concern to Channing. He even dared to suggest that children should be nurtured in that freedom. Again, his theology forced him to a radical position. It's still a radical position in religious education today. And I'd like to close with his well-known words on that subject. The great end in religious instruction is not to stamp our minds upon the young, but to stir up their own. Not to make them see with our eyes, but to look inquiringly and steadily with their own. Not to give them a definite amount of knowledge, but to inspire a fervent love of truth. Not to form an outward regularity, but to touch inward springs. Not to bind them by ineradicable prejudices to our particular sect or peculiar notions, but to prepare them for impartial, conscientious judging of whatever subjects may be offered to their decision. Not to burden their memory, but to quicken and strengthen the power of thought. Not to impose religion upon them in the form of arbitrary rules, but to awaken the conscience, the moral discernment. In a word, the great end is to awaken the soul, to excite and cherish spiritual life.